Hi everyone, and welcome to the official launch of the 84th issue of the Humanitarian Exchange magazine, which is published by the Humanitarian Practice Network, or HPN. I'm Kerry Holloway, and I'm currently the interim coordinator for HPN. So for those of you who don't know, HPN was formed in 1994, so 30 years ago now, as an independent global forum for humanitarian practitioners. Its goal is to provide a platform to amplify the voices of practitioners who are also local actors oftentimes and who may not have another opportunity to get their voice and perspective heard. Our audience is made up of individuals and organizations working in over 130 countries worldwide. These include NGOs, the UN and other multilateral agencies, governments and donors, as well as academic institutions and consultants, and most importantly, other practitioners. So before we get started, just a few housekeeping rules. First, just a reminder, this event is being recorded. The video will be available on the event webpage in a couple of days' time, so the same page that you've come to watch today, and you'll be able to listen back to the discussion through the ODI event podcast channel as well, if you prefer to listen that way. Also, please note that we'll have a dedicated Q&A session in a bit in the event, so please use the Q&A box to submit any questions you have for the panel, and you'll find that below. So please don't put them in the chat, please use the Q&A function. So as an independent forum, HPN offers policymakers, practitioners, and others working in the humanitarian sector a space to share and disseminate information, analysis, and their experiences, and also to learn from one another. As you can imagine, with the forum dating back to the mid-1990s, the way this information has been shared has changed over the years, but currently the main way people interact with HPN is through our website. Here we publish several different types of outputs, from shorter blogs and articles to longer network papers and good practice reviews, as well as our flagship magazine, The Humanitarian Exchange, of which we're launching the 84th issue on climate change, conflict, and displacement with you here today. This issue was co-edited by myself and my colleague, Caitlin Sturridge, and the idea for the issue came as we were doing research on the intersection of climate change, conflict, and displacement several years ago, and realized that a combination of all three of these tended to coexist in many, if not most, of all contemporary crises, though the weight and relevance of each may vary depending on the context. The resulting compounding crisis only served to amplify individual challenges and create increasingly complex and entrenched situations of crisis with few solutions in sight. The contributions we received and the articles that have been published could not be more timely. The combined challenges of these three phenomena must be addressed collectively, but at the same time, deep-seated disconnects continue to persist between sectors, disciplines, and geographies involved. So between humanitarian development, peace-building, and climate actors, between migration and displacement studies, between the social and natural sciences, and between the so-called Global North and Global South. Today, we'll be hearing from the authors of three of the articles that have been included in this edition. First, Imral Islam and Thomas Wilson will share their experiences from Iraq amid extreme heat, drought, and displacement. Next, Madison Jansen and Medina Yunus Mahat will discuss climate mobility and immobility in Kenya, how it intersects with conflict and its gendered dimensions, with a particular focus on pastoralist girls. And finally, Helena O'Mahony will explore whether international human rights law could be mobilized for climate justice. After the three presentations, we'll have time for the questions, so please do use the question feature that's available to submit any questions you have as they speak. So perhaps I'll stop there and hand it over to our first set of presenters, Imral and Tom, over to you.
Thanks, Kerry. Lovely to be here. I'm Imral Islam. I'm the advocacy manager for NRC in Iraq, and I have my colleague Tom with me, so I'll hand it over to him for a second.
Hi there, Tom Wilson. Also working for NRC Iraq as the water and climate specialist. We'd just like to present our findings from our climate and displacement in Iraq, and Imral will lead us through the first few slides, and I'll pick us up at the end. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. I hope you can hear me because I've just minimized the screen. So please let me know if you don't. But I think we'll start with a bit of background. So NRC is a humanitarian organization. We focus on people who've been forced to flee. And in Iraq, we've been here for 13 years. We work across 8 governorates. And we first responded in the aftermath of the Syrian refugee crisis and obviously the IDP internal displacement crisis that occurred post 2016. And specific to climate change, it's almost been a function of our presence here, because we've seen extreme weather increasingly play a part in how it's impacting refugees, those who are still internally displaced, and those who are recovering from displacement. And by that, we essentially mean people who are trying to integrate into the communities that they were displaced into, returning home or relocating. For the report, we look at four governorates, and that's embedded in a lot of our climate programming that Tom leads, and he'll speak about that a little bit more. So we're talking about Anbar in the south, Kirkuk, which is central Iraq, and Nineveh and Salahuddin. Nineveh is in the north. Salahuddin is also in central Iraq as well. And what we're trying to understand for the past 3 years is how much of an impact is extreme weather having on four things. So water security, income and food security, social cohesion, migration and displacement. And those are the four thematic areas of focus that's been very clear to us from the beginning, mostly because it has ties to the durable solution safeties for the humanitarian sector. We're really looking at how climate impacts not all Iraqis. I think that's way out of the scope of what NRC does in Iraq, or any humanitarian organization is able to do. It's really looking specifically at barriers to durable solutions to displacement. The methodology is, it's three streams of data, we like to say. So there's this post-harvest survey that's embedded in the programming we do that's run at the end of every harvest season. And that's looking at a lot of these data points of, with humanitarian assistance, did food and income security show resilience throughout the drought? And each summer is usually worse than the last. So we actually get quite a good trend of income security. We get a lot of trends around protection increasingly, social cohesion, and obviously migration and displacement. Are people looking to move? Are they tying it? Are perceptions of migration and displacement being related very clearly to extreme weather? We run community focus group discussions and a lot of key informant interviews. And that's not just with the people we assist, but also subnational authorities. So we're talking about directorates of agriculture, directorates of water resources in Iraq, but also at the ministerial level. And increasingly, what we've seen a gap in is the other side of the equation, right? I think the humanitarian response in Iraq is a pretty long, drawn-out one, and it's one that's going through a transition from humanitarian to development. So increasingly, we've spoken to donors about it and tried to get insights into their strategy in Iraq, so both humanitarian donors, but also increasingly development donors. And for us, it's also about contextualizing donor strategies with the context on the ground and how we can influence some of that. As I said, I think the scope for us, it's very clear. It's four governorates. Iraq is incredibly diverse with, there are so many variables that you can't necessarily show causation, right? But you can look at that link between climate and displacement. If you've worked in four governorates doing specific programming and you have longitudinal data for over 3 years now, we're again looking at the link between climate and displacement. And what we're actually trying to do here is not necessarily ask for more funding for NRC. I'm very honest about that. We're looking at all of the policy prescriptions that has occurred in Iraq, the government's position as it relates to climate change, which is quite promising, to be honest, the policies that are in development at the national level and subnational level, and what are Iraqi authorities saying about where the gaps are in funding, in roles and responsibilities, what are the frameworks that we can use, and where should that energy be directed? So a lot of what Tom will speak about is the lack of data and monitoring in Iraq, not necessarily just money, although money is a big thing, not just the question of water scarcity, but how it is distributed, what's the state of the water infrastructure? Because increasingly what you see is areas that were underserved during and before armed conflict also are emerging hotspots when it comes to the climate change, climate and weather events. So I'll stop there and I'll hand it over to Tom to walk us through some of the findings, I think.
Thank you, Imran. I'd actually like to start off firstly echoing slightly or emphasizing what Imran had said on climate change and the donor response and the international community response, because what we've seen is not climate change per se across the country directly impacting the communities and populations we serve. What we're seeing overall is more the lack of following those communities affected by displacement into achieving durable solutions. And I think the crux of our point here is climate change is impacting the ability for those vulnerable populations who have been affected by conflict and displacement into return and recovery on the path to achieving durable solutions, whereby climate change is a barrier to that. And it's undermining the investment that the international and national government itself have made to support those populations. The undermining is coming through the lack of livelihood opportunities, the lack of continual investment in allocating water resources or development of water resources, which were previously not existing in these districts where displacement has occurred. We also find that the lack of data available at a district level is very much influencing national and donor policy. So this week I attended the fourth Baghdad International Water Conference, whereby donors, international think tanks, the government of Iraq itself, of course, regional stakeholders, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, regionally and globally, are looking at Iraq as a nation, whereby climate change is impacting different parts to different degrees. However, they're not really boiling it down to the district level. And this is a point of concern, particularly for historic areas of conflict, where most of our populations that we've served have come from. A top line figure and a general narrative that we see is the south of Iraq is severely impacted by climate change because of its downstream from the natural catchment within the country itself, but also from Syria, Turkey and Iran. And not to delve into that transboundary water negotiations and the politics there, but the international community is naturally drawn to the south of Iraq because it to some extent it is more affected by the impact of climate change as surface water and rainwater is affecting it there, but also through current displacement. So current displacement, we're seeing through IOM's DTM tracking, I think up to about 120,000 people moving from rural to urban centres as a result of climate change directly. What we'd like to focus on is the humanitarian response, the previous and current response, whereby we still see populations currently displaced in camp settings or those striving to return to their area of origin and re-establish livelihoods and basic durable solutions, durable returns. So as this slide is showing us, you know, sort of 1.2 million Iraqis are still internally displaced with 2,500 Syrian refugees hosted. If we look at the transition as generally this sector takes an approach to a very linear progression out of humanitarian response through recovery, displacement, durable returns, and even development programming, we're seeing climate change as really undoing the strings of all of that. And this is why we find it particularly poignant to run a drought impact assessment every year, generally covering the populations that we've served. Next slide, please, Imran. So on this drought impact assessment that was working with our rural farming communities, we have seen how their livelihoods have been impacted. So 98% of those who we interviewed, I think it's just over 1,000 respondents in the four major governorates that were impacted by conflict with ISIS, have stated that they are reducing the land available to them for agricultural practice during drought years. We've seen a correlation, a clear correlation within that. I'd just like to emphasize that between 2021, 22 and 23, 22 we can consider as a drought year. And that drought year is showing our brief correlations on a 3-year process. So we are seeing on the drought years, more than the other years, reduction in agricultural land being productive. And that productivity, of course, is impacting livelihoods and thereby the income and revenue for households. Coping mechanisms are increasing during drought years, and we're seeing sort of sale of assets, reduction spending, reduction of household consumption, food consumption, reduction of irrigation, water. But one of the more concerning ones is something that doesn't follow this correlation. So as I mentioned, correlation between drought year and not drought year, the major concern is we've seen an increase in migration as a adaptive or coping mechanism. And this trend is the point of concern because, of course, migration may impact many other social cohesion and other areas of the country, as general findings are rural to urban migration through other assessments that we've done, policy work in the governorate of Nainoa. There are no policies in place nor strategy to accommodate migration into urban centres in areas that have a historical failed lack of investment in infrastructure for the multitude of services that would be required for a population. And thereby, for additional migration, you see an additional burden on outdated and old infrastructure to support them. And typically, as we start to see, migration causes tension. So the final correlation that we've seen is those drought years, there are at the community level in the areas of displacement, increased community tensions during drought years. So apart from or aside from the challenges that climate change poses to achieving durable solutions, we're seeing it potentially as a driver for additional displacement, migration, human mobility, or potential conflict and social incohesion. Next slide, please, Imran. So, of course, we have some recommendations. These will come more or less from the NRC in our perspective. And as I've mentioned, we'd attended the Baghdad Water Conference this year, and the level of impact that climate change and drought and water insecurity has on Iraq is immense. This is something that is going to be a point of national security and regional security. It's a multitude of requirements, from governance to transboundary water agreements to investment to corruption, that exist in the context of Iraq. But from the lens of NRC and the populations that we've served, we really would like to see more monitoring, regulation and allocation of resources to continue supporting these populations who have recently been affected and displaced. I mean, we're coming from, or personally, I'm coming from the climate infrastructure livelihoods lens. But of course, if we look at this from a protection perspective, from a multi-generational displaced and conflict-affected population, this is a dire situation that we might see in the coming sort of 5 to 10 years. So more investment allocation. We need national and sub-national policies. We need district-level action plans. And these policies need to allocate to a lot of the risks and mitigation, coping mechanisms that we're seeing. And funding climate adaptation. I think climate change is still relatively vague in terms of the humanitarian perspective. But I think when we're zoning in on that as a barrier to achieving durable solutions, which ultimately is what this sector is there to support displaced populations in achieving, this is an area that climate change can really impact and be involved in some of the advocacy and lobbying to support these populations in achieving it. I'll leave it there, and thank you all for listening.
Great. Thank you, Tom and Emeril. And again, as I said, if you have questions as people are presenting, please do use the Q&A function that you'll find at the bottom of the screen. Next up, we have Madison and Medina. So Madison, over to you.
Great. Can everyone see my screen okay? Yes, okay. Yes. Fantastic. So hi, everyone. I'm Madison Jansen. I'm the Senior Humanitarian Programs Officer at World Jewish Relief. And I'm joined here today by my colleague and my co-author, Medina. Medina, can you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, everyone. My name is Medina Yunis Mahat, and I'm the Gender and Health Coordinator at Pastoral Youth Girls Initiative. Good to be here today.
Great. So just to give a brief recap of what the article covered, we spoke about climate change, conflict, and displacement, particularly in relation to pastoralist communities in Garissa County, Kenya. And Garissa County is a region in eastern Kenya that is being severely impacted by climate change. And here, this looks like increased temperatures, erratic rainfall patterns, and prolonged periods of drought. And while we know that climate change is impacting the entire world in some way, Garissa County is unique because 90% of the population here are pastoralists, which means that they rely on natural water sources and the land to feed and sustain their livestock. And while pastoralists would typically migrate seasonally along traditional patterns and routes, these changes in weather patterns due to climate change are leading to altered movement. And what our article did was explore how this altered movement leads to conflict by talking about three specific pathways. And the first pathway that we discussed was if the resources that the pastoralists are trying to use are already claimed by farmers, if pastoralists are trying to recuperate their livestock losses through theft or cattle rustling. And then we also identified food insecurity as being a pathway to intra-household tensions and increased instances of gender-based violence. And another one of the things the article looked at is how gender relates to mobility. And what we discussed is that mobility, and particularly extended and altered mobility due to the changes in weather patterns, can negatively impact women and girls by disconnecting them from their support systems, social networks, and distancing them from sexual and reproductive health care services. So what is the role of NGOs, INGOs, and CSOs, civil society organizations, in supporting pastoralist communities? One thing the article identified was how pastoralist communities will rely on their own hierarchies more than external stakeholders like NGOs or INGOs. And so we really see grassroots organizations being best placed to be plugged into these existing structures and therefore best situated to understand the needs as determined by the communities themselves. And so therefore we see the role of INGOs really to support these grassroots organizations and the general localization movement more broadly through global coordination with donors, raising awareness for and advocating for this often marginalized and forgotten community. And then the role of donors as well is to ensure that they're creating an enabling environment, especially if they're implementing through these local partners for flexible and adaptable interventions. And one thing that our organizations have found is that prioritizing cash as a modality is one of these flexible and adaptable interventions that suits communities like this. And I'll hand it over to Medina now to discuss the next few points.
Thank you, Madison. We also looked at the community-led design, and in this, the most effective strategy for fostering impactful and sustainable change is by empowering communities to actively participate in development initiatives. And by this, by entrusting them to identify their challenges, prioritizing their needs, and devising solutions, we enable genuine grassroots-driven progress. And as grassroots organizations such as Pastoralist Girls Initiative, our role is to facilitate and support the endeavors, serving as enablers rather than directors. This can be achieved through the survivor and community-led response, SCLR approach, which underscores the pivotal role of survivors and affected communities in shaping responses to crises, especially in humanitarian emergencies and disasters. This approach champions the empowerment of individuals impacted by crises, empowering them to play a central role in decision-making processes through concerning their recovery and response efforts. Through the SCLR approach, communities take the lead in both designing and implementing response strategies, ensuring solutions are tailored to their unique circumstances and needs. We also looked at localization, and in this we talked about INGOs such as the World Jewish Relief, should prioritize partnering with grassroots organizations such as Pastoralist Girls Initiatives for several reasons. We look at INGOs working with other INGOs within working in Garissa. We said grassroots organizations have, such as Pastoralist Girls Initiative, have cultivated trust within the community through their sustained presence and direct engagement, which is invaluable for effective humanitarian work. Also, the personnel in these organizations, such as the grassroots organizations, are often members of the local community. So they possess an intimate understanding of its dynamics, culture, and needs. This familiarity enables them to navigate complex social structures and address challenges with sensitivity and insights. And also, grassroots organizations possess a unique ability to access hard-to-reach areas and vulnerable communities that larger, more bureaucratic organizations may struggle to reach. So their localized approach ensures that aid and support are delivered efficiently and effectively to those who need it most, minimizing logistical barriers and ensuring resources are maximally utilized. We have, by cooperating or collaborating with grassroots organizations, INGOs can tap into a wealth of local knowledge and networks, enhancing the relevance and sustainability of their interventions. So in essence, we are saying prioritizing partnerships with grassroots organizations not only amplifies the impact of humanitarian efforts, but also fosters genuine community empowerment and resilience building, laying the groundwork for long-term positive change. Next slide. So in this, we were looking at alternatives or what is next for pastoralist communities in adapting or in adapting to climate change. And maybe we looked at alternatives such as market alternatives and adaptation approaches. And in this, you find that pastoralist communities face increasingly vulnerability due to climate change impact on their traditional livelihoods. So as a suggestion, and we are not trying to change people's way of life, but diversifying income sources beyond sole resilience on pastoralism is an alternative they can tap into. Alternative livelihoods such as agriculture, handicraft, or tourism can also provide supplementary income streams. This diversification helps against the risks posed by climate variability and extreme weather events. Moreover, integrating climate-resilient livestock breeds like camels into herds, strengthening resilience, is also another alternative. Camels exhibit adaptability to arid conditions, requiring less and forage compared to other livestock. So they offer a viable solution for sustaining livelihoods in harsh environments prone to climate-induced challenges. So fostering community-based adaptation initiatives empowers pastoralists to implement localized strategies. These may include water management systems and early warning systems for droughts and floods. Collaborative efforts with governmental and non-governmental organizations can provide access to resources, knowledge, and technology that enhance adaptive capacities. And ultimately, embracing diversified livelihood and resilient livestock breeds coupled with community-driven adaptation measures builds resilience, ensuring the sustainability of pastoralist communities in the face of climate change. And lastly, we also looked at traditional conflict resolution mechanisms. And in this, we said, conflicts threatens the livelihood and food security of pastoralist communities. It disrupts the access to vital resources and disproportionately affects women and girls who often bear the brunt of violence. So integrating traditional conflict resolution mechanisms like the maslaha system is crucial in this sense. Maslaha, deeply ingrained in pastoralist culture, prioritizes the collective welfare operating through customary laws and community elders' wisdom to restore peace and social harmony. It fosters inclusive decision-making involving community members, elders, and leaders. While effective in resolving conflicts, the Maslaha system has its own setbacks or drawbacks, particularly regarding when it comes to gender-based violence. With decision makers predominantly male, women voices are often marginalized, leading to biased outcomes. So balancing the Maslaha system's strength in conflict resolution with its gender biases requires addressing gender inclusivity within its decision-making structures. So by leveraging the strengths of the Maslaha system while addressing its limitation, pastoralist communities can achieve more equitable conflict resolution processes. And I think that was the end of our presentation. Thank you very much. We welcome any questions.
Great. Thank you, Medina, and thank you, Madison. As we've said, if you do have questions, please do put them in the chat. And our final presentation today is from Helena. So Helena, over to you.
Thank you, Kerry. I'm just going to share my screen. Okay. Can everyone see my slides there? Okay.
Yes, we see you.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Kerry and the team, for inviting me to speak here today. So I'm going to try and keep this as brief as I can, just because I'm conscious that we want to make sure we have some time for questions at the end. So my name is Helen O'Mahony. I work in Mishkondareya, which is a British law firm based here in London. So I don't work in a humanitarian organization, so I think my perspective may be slightly different to the other presentations that were here today. But my background is in humanitarian and human rights NGOs, specifically human rights law. So my kind of area of interest is the intersection between climate change and human rights law. So when I had the opportunity to submit an article or an idea for this issue, I really wanted to think about conflict and displacement as sort of human rights issues that are either caused or exacerbated by the climate crisis, and then think about what can the human rights system do in addressing these issues, and sort of more widely, how can the human rights system contribute to greater state accountability for climate change and climate policies in addressing these issues. So I'll talk quickly through the kind of central thesis of my article, which I've tried to sort of narrow down into key points. And then I'm going to speak about the case that my article was centered on, which is based on the lovely people that you can see here on this slide, which they are Torres Strait Islanders, and a human rights case that they took to the UN, which was the first of its kind, the first successful climate case to go through a UN treaty body, which is really exciting. And I'll finish with a development in this space, which has actually happened since this issue was published, which I think maybe demonstrates just how kind of fast moving, I suppose, and developing this space is. So I'll start with just kind of an overview of the central thesis of my article. So the article is entitled "Litigating the Climate Crisis: Is the International Human Rights System the Answer to the Climate Emergency?" So my starting point was that essentially one of the key problems that we have in addressing the climate crisis is state accountability. So how can we ensure that states are implementing their obligations under the Paris Agreement, and what accountability mechanisms do we have for when they don't adhere to those obligations? And the other problem that we have in terms of the climate crisis is time. So we all know how time consuming and lengthy international processes can be. I guess that sort of informed my starting point of thinking about what are the systems that we already have that can contribute to the fight against climate change in a just and inclusive way. So looking at the international human rights system, and by that I mean the UN human rights system, and then also the regional human rights bodies being the European Court of Human Rights, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights as well, those types of bodies, the African Court of Human Rights. So how do we mobilize them in the fight against climate change? So my opinion here is that the best way to do that is for us to reinterpret existing human rights, which are well established, and sort of understand them and expand them in the context of climate change. So states already have obligations under international human rights law to respect, protect, and fulfill our human rights. So respect in the sense of a negative obligation not to unlawfully interfere with our rights, but also positive obligations to protect and fulfill our human rights against violations by third parties. And that brings us to the final point then. How do we reinterpret these state obligations? And my suggestion in the article is through litigation. So litigation is sort of a catch-all term essentially for anything that goes through a court system, any kind of court case. And in the international human rights system, that means UN human rights treaty bodies, charter bodies, and it also means the European Court of Human Rights, the African Court of Human Rights, etc. So litigation can do a number of things, and it can be really powerful. So when we bring cases through international courts like this, it allows a space for treaty bodies and for judges to consider the existing state obligations under human rights in the context of climate change and essentially broaden our understanding of these rights. And what we can do by expanding those obligations is we can essentially create a mechanism for individual citizens to hold their states accountable when they fail to meet those obligations. Litigation also has a number of added benefits beyond creating precedents and changing our understanding of human rights law. It can also provide effective remedies for victims. It leads to increased scrutiny on national climate policies. And perhaps most importantly, it can lead to international pressure on individual states. And for anybody kind of familiar with the UN system or the international law system generally, an awful lot of it comes down to international politics and pressure. So with that in mind, the kind of central case that I looked at was the case of Daniel Billy versus Australia, which was a submission to the Human Rights Committee, the UN Human Rights Committee. So this is a UN treaty body, and they hear cases and submissions in relation to violations of rights under the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, which is one of the founding treaties of our international human rights system. And just to kind of briefly speak to what the case was about, essentially these lovely people here in the picture, they're known as the Torres Strait Eight. So they are a group of eight Torres Strait Islanders. They're part of an indigenous population that live in the Torres Strait Islands, which are an archipelago of low-lying islands to the north of Australia. The islands are particularly vulnerable to climate change. So increased flooding, extreme weather events, loss of agricultural land, and particularly rising sea levels are having a harmful and direct impact on their livelihoods, their food systems, and particularly for this case, also their traditional way of life as an Indigenous community. So many are coming to the realization that they actually need to leave their homes and are being forcibly displaced. So they essentially argued that a number of their human rights have been violated by Australia's failure to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions and to protect them by adopting various adaptation and mitigation efforts against the impacts of climate change. They argued a whole host of different violations. Not all of them were successful, but two were. So the first one was a violation of Article 17, which protects one's right to privacy, family, and home life free from unlawful interference. And the second one was Article 27, which is the right of minority groups to enjoy their culture. And so essentially, the Human Rights Committee What they did, and what's really interesting, and I'm conscious not to make this too kind of legal and technical, but what they essentially did is they looked at the state obligations that Australia had within the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, and then they interpreted those in light of the Paris Agreement, which is a really interesting development because it's essentially, it's looking at international climate law and how it informs international human rights obligations and linking the two together in a way that it hadn't really been done before. And so I've put on the slide here that Daniel Billy is a landmark case for three key reasons. So firstly, it's the first time that an international tribunal has found a country has violated human rights law through inadequate climate policy. Secondly, it's the first time a state has been found responsible for its greenhouse gas emissions under international human rights law. And finally, it's the first time that an Indigenous community's rights to culture has been found to be violated by inadequate climate policy. So it's an incredibly exciting case. And I think it's also worth noting, aside from it having expanded our understanding and interpretation of international human rights, it also kind of fed into the earlier point I made of mounting international pressure. So before the judgment was actually even handed down, so before we even knew that the Torres Strait Eight had been successful in their claim, the Australian government committed $25 million Australian dollars to the islands for urgent adaptation measures amid the increasing pressure to respond. So that's a really exciting development there and kind of demonstrates, I think, the efficacy of litigation in addressing some of these issues, particularly in the context of displacement here. And so I will finish, and I'm conscious of time, I'll finish on a really exciting development, and I will try and keep this brief. So I finished my article essentially saying that we need more cases to understand really how this can be applied in practice and what this looks like in terms of the regional courts. And my prayers were answered. So on the 9th of April, the European Court of Human Rights handed down three climate judgments. Two were unsuccessful, largely on kind of procedural admissibility grounds. But one was successful, and it's this one here, which is the Klimasenioren versus Switzerland. Excuse my German pronunciation. And you can see them here, these lovely ladies who are an association of around 2,000 members, all of whom are senior women. And they essentially argued that their health was endangered by the increase in heat waves being caused by climate change. So they relied on research around senior women being particularly vulnerable to the impacts of heatwave, and in turn that Switzerland is already experiencing a significant increase in temperatures. So while this isn't necessarily relevant to the conversation today around conflict and displacement, it is relevant in terms of that broadening out of our understanding of human rights obligations and what these human rights provisions actually protect and mean. So the court held by an overwhelming majority that there had been a violation of Article 8 of the European Convention of Human Rights, which essentially protects the right to respect for private and family life and the home. So I've included just two quite significant quotes here from the judgment. So the first one, in which they're kind of interpreting what Article 8 means, and they say that it provides a right for individuals to enjoy effective protection by the state authorities from serious adverse effects on their life, health, well-being, and quality of life arising from the harmful effects and risks caused by climate change. And significantly, I suppose, again, they interpreted the European Convention of Human Rights in light of the Paris Agreement again, and best available scientific evidence on this, and held that effective respect for the rights protected by Article 8 of the Convention require that each contracting state undertake measures for the substantial and progressive reduction of their respective greenhouse gas emission levels with a view to reaching net neutrality within, in principle, the next three decades. So I think this case demonstrates that it is a growing body of jurisprudence, but there is a growing consensus that international climate law informs the state obligations under human rights law. And when we think about things like conflict and displacement, if we imagine them as human rights issues which are either caused or exacerbated by the climate crisis, and essentially we then can think of them as a state failing. And I posit this as a way in which we can increase state accountability for their climate policies and the impacts that their climate inaction is having on citizens, on their everyday lives. So I'll finish there, just to kind of reiterate that the human rights system, I think, has the capacity to create an incredibly powerful enforcement mechanism to drive government response to the climate crisis. You know, the human rights system has been instrumental in a whole host of social change since 1948, since its inception. And let's see if we can turn it green, I think. So I'll finish there. Thank you so much for listening. And I look forward to any questions and discussion on this.
Great. Thanks, Helena. That was very interesting. As someone who's not a lawyer by trade, I find it fascinating how it could potentially help us through some of these tricky processes. So we've had a few questions come in. I'm going to read them and kind of direct them to the speaker, and I'll read them all in one go so that, well, everybody but the first person gets to think a bit about their answer before they give it. Sorry to the first person. And Helena, I don't think we've got questions for you yet because you've just finished up, but I'm going to take the speaker's prerogative or the moderator's prerogative and ask you one that I've been wondering. So welcome to that at the end. But maybe for Imral and Tom, since you guys went first, we've got two questions that I think maybe you guys could speak to. So the first one is around the role of data to better prepare for humanitarian emergencies caused by the climate crisis. So how do you see, like, what data would be necessary, I guess, to what do we need to be collecting? What do we need to be thinking about? And how do you see the major climate crisis that will most impact humanitarian planning? So what's coming up in the future that we need to be looking at now, I guess? That's quite a big question. Don't feel like you've got to have all the answers. And then the other one that is directed to you guys is, you mentioned conversations you were having with different donors, so humanitarian donors and development donors. So how have the conversations differed? Are there are some more receptive to others about what you're saying and the specific policies you're advocating for, and how can we kind of take that and learn from it? So how should we target our conversations, maybe, rather, if we're talking to like a development donor or a humanitarian donor, or are they the same? The second question is for Medina and Madison. So this is around working with local organizations based in the community. You guys said it was very important to do this, but did you identify any barriers that needed to be overcome to do this well? And how can partners make sure they're working with communities and local organizations in the most sustainable way? So that will be for you guys. And then Helena, the one that I'm going to ask is, this is Humanitarian Partner, Networks and Partnerships Week. And I find it really interesting what you're talking about litigating for some of these things as an alternative to maybe just as humanitarians kind of trying to solve the, I guess, the consequences of the climate crisis. This is maybe trying to put a little responsibility back in to try to prevent some things in the future if, you know, if you're trying to use international human rights law to say, well, what we've been doing so far isn't working, so how do we do it better in the future? So I guess my question to you is, how do you feel that lawyers and people who work with international human rights law can partner with humanitarian organizations to kind of drive this agenda forward? Are there any kind of connections that the two could make that would kind of strengthen the arguments of people? So sorry if I broke up. I think everyone just froze a bit, but hopefully you got the question. If not, I can send it to you privately. But Imral and Tom, over to you. And also just to say, please make your answers quite brief because we only have about 10 minutes. So Imral and Tom, over to you.
Sure. I'll take the first question for NRC and I'll be as brief. Well, I mean, it's a huge question and a very good question, but as brief as possible. Data is hugely important for adaptive resilience, for planning for future shocks, for long-term slow onset emergencies. This is a really important area to focus on. I think the question is, is there never enough data, or sometimes is there too much data? At some point, you need to make decisions and have action plans and responses. I would say if we boil it down to the individual farmer in a remote area that hasn't got access to the internet easily, or doesn't even know how to navigate some of these data that is available online, such as rainfall planning, precipitation predictions, longer term climate change impact predictions. These things year by year support the farmer in deciding what he'll do with his crop, and that will hugely, we've seen it in Iraq, of data being distributed to farmers. They can plan for next year to either seed or save that money and invest it into a different value chain or agricultural or livelihood practice, or that may be for a resilience for next year. There's in Iraq, we see a huge lack of data in groundwater, for example. So this requires a lot of investment, multiple years of planning. But groundwater is a major point for resilience in the dry and arid regions, because if rainfall fails, people rely on groundwater. And we see that groundwater is overexploited, and there's a lack of legal agreements on transboundary groundwater water sharing agreements. So there's never enough data, and absolutely it should be something more scientifically involved in humanitarian response and longer term resilience, durable solutions planning. Massive topic, but yeah, that's my brief response. Thank you.
I was scared we're going to talk for 2 hours about this, but it is massive. I'll start with a quick example as well. Then I think in a humanitarian transition, when we talk about the nexus, and apologies for using that word, I think accountability and inclusion are really, really tough to actually achieve, because the responsibility is, it's not a linear division of responsibility. It's not an equitable division of responsibility. You're trying to hold the state accountable while simultaneously asking a handover of donor responsibility from humanitarians to development counterparts, very different organisms, very different ways of working, very different standards of inclusion, humanitarian principles, targeting, all of that. On the ground, for example, if you are a widow in Iraq in one of these governorates that's extremely affected, and you've lost your husband, you're struggling, you're going to the courts to reclaim your rights to property. A development donor, oftentimes, because of risk aversion and because of the way it's set up, you won't fall into the targeting precisely because you're seen as a risky investment. It would go through ministries, it would go through the whole of society approach. So you would end up excluding. I think a simple solution to that is donors need to talk to each other a little bit more. Not all of us need to do everything. Humanitarian agencies, peace building organizations, very different remit of programming. But I think there's a way to align that a little bit better. Very simple answer, very simplistic, sorry.
Great, thank you. Madison and Medina, over to you guys around local organizations and barriers to working with them.
Sure, yeah, I think this is a great question because as a member of an INGO, I might have a very different response to Medina, who's a member of a civil society organization. So my response to this, I think one major barrier is that sometimes local partners might not have the training or capacity to implement things that donors might prioritize. And that can be really off-putting for a donor that wants to partner with a local organization, but also wants programs to happen in the most inclusive and effective way possible. And I think to overcome that barrier, you have to prioritize making strategic investments to build the capacities of your local partners. So one thing that World Jewish Relief actually does is a grant every year that we give to some of our local partners to make these strategic investments in their own organization. So things that might not usually be included in program budgets, like purchasing new softwares or hiring consultants to make strategic plans for their organizations. And I think by doing that, we have found that really has improved both the quality and the sustainability of our partnerships with local organizations. And Medina, if you want to expand on that, please.
Yeah, I think we had the same points. For me, I think the barrier in terms of working with local organizations will be, like what Madison said, local organizations often face resource constraints including not only financial, but also in terms of personnel, in terms of capacity or trainings. We find that NGOs are more advanced in that sense. And so to overcome this, also to support, like what she said, capacity development of local organizations by providing training, resources, and mentorships to enhance their skills and capabilities. That's one. Also, another barrier could be lack of understanding of local contexts, culture, and needs of the community. We find that some of these NGOs or organizations are not familiar with the local context, or are not appreciative of the culture and the needs of the community. So it's crucial for NGOs to actually understand the local context and also appreciate the culture and needs of the community. And also just maintaining transparency in all aspects of partnership, including decision-making processes, resource allocation, and project outcomes, will go a long way in working effectively with NGOs and other partners as far as local organization is concerned. Thank you. And thank you for that question.
Great. Thank you, Medina. And Helena, over to you. We've got 3 minutes left, but if I do have a 1 minute wrap up, so you've got 2 minutes to give us your answer.
Okay. Thanks, Kerry. I will try and keep it brief. So in terms of how humanitarian organizations can work with the legal profession on some of the stuff that I've been talking about. So the first thing I think that springs to mind for me is just the experience, just the on the ground experience of working in countries and understanding what are the most pressing needs of people, and what are the most pressing human rights implications of the climate change, climate crisis. So how is it impacting people on the ground? That is incredibly useful information for us to then consider and think about through a human rights lens, but that's information and kind of context I think that we wouldn't have as a law firm, that humanitarian practitioners do have. I think as well, Medina touched on it briefly, but understanding of the local context kind of feeds into that, working with communities and building those relationships in an inclusive kind of way is, you know, just something that we obviously can't have the same sort of level of experience with. And then I think, I mean, Tom spoke about data. That's another kind of big stumbling block for us is, obviously in legal claims you need to establish causation, so thinking about, you know, can we actually attribute what's happening on the ground to climate change in a clear way, and who has the data around that and how can we kind of demonstrate that, and I think with that, it's, you know, in the case of the Torres Strait Islands that I spoke about earlier, it was quite clear cut, you know, they're low-lying islands and they're subject to rising sea levels. So they're literally losing land by the year. But in most situations, the kind of intersection between climate change, conflict, displacement, other human rights violations isn't going to be quite as straightforward. So just having access to that data is incredibly important for us to be able to take these claims.
Great, thanks. And thank you everyone who has tuned in for this event. Nusheen, our events colleague, has put links in the chat to the entire exchange, humanitarian exchange, so please do check that out. These three articles are in there, and there's 12 other articles that are just as interesting that we'd love for you to read. And also, please do reach out if you have any feedback about this panel or about any of the articles that are included. We'd also be grateful if you could spend 2 minutes filling in the survey that's posted in the chat, so that helps us capture feedback from those engaging with our work and measuring the impact of that engagement. Thanks again, everyone, and have a lovely afternoon.
Thank you.